for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Service and therapy dogs are specially trained to help people. They've gone to Newtown, Boston, and West Texas to provide comfort in times of crisis and tragedy. Brian Hare of the Duke Canine Cognition Center is here to explain why the relationship between dogs and humans is unique in the animal kingdom. Also, Amy McCullough of the American Humane Society and Paul Mundell of Canine Companions for Independence. I know many of you love dogs and will want to join us. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning and welcome to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Amy, I want to start with you because I know you were in Boston last week with your therapy dog, Bailey. Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, like all Americans, when we heard the news of the Boston bombings, we wanted to help. And so American Humane Association authorized Bailey and I to travel to Boston, and we spent 2 days there. This was approximately a week after the bombing. And the first day that we were there, we spent the bulk of the day at the two bomb sites. It was the first day that they had opened back up Boylston Street, and there were two makeshift memorials set up at each of the bomb sites. And so when Bailey and I stepped onto that street, wow, the powerful emotion. I mean, the feeling was palpable. Here's this busy metropolitan street with dozens, hundreds of people, yet the silence and a wait. And so when Bailey and I approached the first memorial, people started to approach us. They would notice Bailey, and soon people are sort of forming a semicircle around Bailey, and she's going from person to person, wagging, and people are petting her, and the emotions that I felt and heard from the people was, it was just so powerful. Some people were silent, but tears running down their faces as they pet her. Other people had questions about Bailey, and then some would talk about sort of what they were feeling at that point. There was a man who said that he had come there that morning to the memorial specifically because he had a son who had passed away from cancer when he was about Martin Richard's age. And so he felt moved to come there to the memorial and pay his respects.
Tell me what kind of dog Bailey is and what kind of training she's had.
She is a golden retriever, and she has been trained through a national organization called Pet Partners. And so she and I had to complete training, and she goes through an assessment every 2 years to make sure that she still has the skills and aptitude to be a therapy dog. So while we were there, we also looped in with a local group called Tufts Paws for People, and they put us in touch with a couple of other organizations so we could visit some other people like the first responders we spent time with. We spent some time at a counseling session for race volunteers, and so it was really an amazing 2 days while we were there.
Amy McCullough, she's National Director of Animal Assisted Therapy for the American Humane Society. We've got lots of pictures on our website, drshow.org, of Amy and Bailey and of canine companion dogs, so you can see them all there. Paul Mundell, one of Canine Companions' dogs, also had a job in Boston. Tell us about Wenna, a 3-year-old black lab and golden retriever cross.
Yes, yes. Well, Wenna was there with, Wenna is a canine companion graduate, as you said, and she was there with her handler, Lori, who lives in the Boston area. And normally, Laurie and Wenna are kind of victim advocates. They work with children and victims of crime, and Wenna provides comfort. And so, given the tragedy in Boston, I mean, as Amy just described, you know, these are the times when the magic that dogs can express is so needed.
What is that magic?
Well, you know, that's a great question, and that's what we spend a lot of time thinking about. And at Canine Companions, what we try to, you know, facilitate. You know, I think it's unique to dogs. The kind of empathy that we feel for them, and we believe that they feel for us, is something that is exclusive in all the creatures around us. And I think that. You know, one of the things that we try to do is through breeding and through training and socialization, and of course training of the handlers who's going to be working with the dog, try to kind of minimally get out of the way of that magic, so to speak. In other words, get it so the dog is comfortable in any environment and has the sort of temperament that's going to be happy doing it.
And what kinds of folks does Wenna work with ordinarily?
So day in and day out, Wenna works with people who are the victims of crime. Very often, especially in the case of children, as we all know, when they've been subject to trauma, and feeling threatened already, you know, relating to strangers, particularly strange adults, is not the easiest thing in the world. Dogs enable. Children will interact with Wenna in a way that they won't with strange adults.
Paul Mundell, he's National Director of Canine Programs for Canine Companions for Independence. Now, turning to you, Bryant Nahair, you are the co-author of a new book titled The Genius of Dogs, How Dogs Are Smarter Than You Think, and I have always known that. But tell me what that title implies.
Well, I think what's exciting for dog lovers everywhere to know is that science is finally woken up and realized what everybody's known already, which is that dogs are geniuses, and that they're really important to study. And that we can learn a lot about animal psychology and even human psychology if we understand dogs better. So about 10 years ago, what people would have said about dogs is, well, why would you study a dog? They're totally unremarkable. They're just a normal mammal. Yeah, we have them, but they're artificially selected, et cetera. But what happened a little over 10 years ago is we discovered that dogs have an unbelievable ability to, relative to other species, relative to wolves, relative to great apes.
Cats, too.
Understand us in terms of our gestural communication, to respond to spoken words, to also potentially respond to how we're feeling, etc. And one of the most fun findings, really, and this is all scientifically demonstrated, is that dogs actually really prefer people to dogs. And so people have actually done the studies where you give dogs the choice. Do you want to hang out with a dog or do you want to hang out with a person? And the answer is they want to hang out with people.
Bryant Nahair, he's professor of evolutionary anthropology, director of the Duke Canine Cognition Center. He's co-author of The Genius of Dogs and co-founder of Dognition. Tell me what Dognition means.
Well, Dognition is really exciting because we've learned so much about dogs, now we have the opportunity to provide people at home to actually use some of the science through Dognition.com to play games with their own dog. These are cognitive games to not find out whether your dog is smart or not. I can tell you, if you're listening to the show and excited about dogs, then your dog is already a genius because it's convinced you that you should take care of it. And so what Dognition is about is helping you understand your dog as an individual. Is your dog one that has a lot of empathy relative to other dogs? Is your dog a dog that's very communicative relative to other dogs? Is your dog a dog that has a remarkable memory? Is it a dog that is capable of reasoning? Is your dog one that is perhaps a little too cunning, i.e. it sometimes uses its intelligence against you? So Dognition helps you play some of these games to actually understand more about what dog you're living with. Just quickly, my own dog, when I tested him, I'm
what
an expert.
Kind?
He is, my joke is, he's an American black dog. He's from the shelter.
Okay.
he's very
Small
rare.
Small dog, big dog.
He's a big dog. He's okay. a big dog, and he knows it. And so I played Dognition with him, and I'm an expert. I do this for a living, and I thought, okay, he's not going to be particularly empathic, and he's very communicative, but inferential reasoning, no way. And completely did exactly opposite of everything I predicted. And so I didn't know my dog as well as I thought I did, and that's what Dognition.com is all about.
Now, Nancy Robertson, a producer on this program, went to do this with her very own dog. She said, you really need two people to do this.
Right. So if your dog is really good at sitting and staying, you can do it on your own. But if you're looking for a fun date with somebody that, you know, might enjoy dogs together with you, this is a great opportunity to spend some time with people you care about.
But why would you need a second person?
Oh, you only need a second person if your dog can't sit or stay, because somebody has to hold the dog while you're playing the games and then let them go to make their choices.
All right. Brian Hare, Amy McCullough, Paul Mundell. They're all here to talk about dogs as therapy dogs, dogs as comfort dogs, dogs as genius dogs. We'll take a short break here, and I hope you'll join us. Go to our website, drshow.org. See the pictures. Give us a call. I look forward to speaking with you. And we have lots of callers waiting. We've got lots of emails. Here's one from Candy in Freeport, Illinois. She said, just saw the documentary Shelter Me. Please talk about the programs that provide dogs to be trained as service dogs via correctional facilities. This documentary showed what must be a wonderful program for inmates, as well as providing the animals to the people in need of them.
I can't speak specifically about that program, although I can tell you that that many programs, including Canine Companions, use prison programs as either part of, as we do, part of the rearing process for some of our puppies. Some other programs use the inmates as kind of the trainers as well. And, you know, the way we view it, you know, for those prisons that are part of the kind of Canine Companions puppy rearing scheme, in many ways it's a double benefit. I mean, obviously we're getting dogs that are well socialized, well-trained, but at the same time, the prison inmates are getting kind of a meaningful activity they can do. You know, the reports that we get from them is that, you know, they find it very rewarding because they feel like, you know, in many respects, they're contributing something positive. They're not kind of just sitting with dead time, but they're actually doing something to benefit people.
Paul, can you clear up the terminology here? Therapy dog, caregiving dog, you know, all kinds of different designations.
I can certainly try. I think, you know, the clearest, you've got the sort of traditional designations of, you know, guide dog or dog guide, more properly even, service dog, which is typically a dog that's working with somebody with some sort of mobility impairment, and typically that would be a wheelchair. Then you've got therapy dogs. Those are dogs that work in kind of a wide variety of situations, you know, similar to what Amy was describing. A particular kind of type of therapy dog is a Canine Companions facility dog, or other schools like ours also use that terminology. Facility dog is a therapy dog, so to speak, that's had certain kind of training and works with typically a professional, kind of some therapist that does that as part of their career. Hearing dogs or signal dogs is the older designation for dogs that work with deaf or hearing impaired people. Comfort dogs is something newer and is a kind of a subset, you might say, of a therapy dog. It's a dog that, you know, is like the Newtown or Boston dogs are often referred to as comfort dogs. In other words, they're as the name implies, giving comfort to victims of trauma.
So, Amy, there's got to be a different set of standards, a different approach to training for each of these designations.
There should be, and there are different levels of service dogs depending on the certifying body. There's a few different organizations that certify or register therapy dogs, and some of them do have different sort of levels. For example, with Pet Partners, they have a predictable rating and a complex rating.
What does that mean?
It's to describe the type of setting that the dog will be performing animal-assisted therapy within. So it has to do with the population that they'll be working with. It has to do with the amount of staff intervention that is at that facility, and then the goals of the interaction. So you're looking at a different dog that might go into an intensive care unit and be working with frail elders versus maybe a dog that goes to a youth correctional facility and runs outside and plays with the child. So there are definitely different applications that these dogs are used in. And so it's incumbent on the facility primarily to ensure that they have policies and procedures in place to make sure that the dogs that they are inviting in to serve their population are qualified and a good fit.
And I wonder what that means. For example, is there a certain breed that's more likely to be amenable to this kind of training? For example, as a hearing dog, Brian.
Well, I mean, actually, Paul would be the expert here on how you train these dogs and why different breeds have been chosen for the purposes that they're being used for. But I think in general, you know, one of the things that we found in our own research, where one of our projects is funded by the National Institute of Health, to actually work with CCI, the Canine Companions for Independence, to help them even come up with better ways to identify dogs that will be appropriate for the different jobs they do. And I'd tell you, one of the first things that you notice is the temperament of these dogs seems really to be different than your normal dog.
How so?
Just incredibly calm and sort of almost stoic in a way. And, you know, really nothing bothers them. And so they can handle a lot of stress, and they are not going to be bothered or even attracted to things that my dog, you know, if there's another dog, my dog wants to go meet it. And these guys, they're really concentrating on what they're there to do.
Can't you tell from puppyhood whether a dog is going to have that kind of temperament.
So they have. So Paul has some great tests, and different organizations use tests to do this. And part of our job has been, can we do even better? So Paul, maybe you. I don't know if you want to speak to that.
Sure. That kind of early predictive test is in many ways the holy grail for us, because we have all of these dogs and we want to know which ones to devote resources to and which ones not. And, you know, certainly the dogs that are either going to be stellar at the work or are going to be true kind of failures at the work, those are detectable early on. But there's a broad kind of middle range, and that's where we're really devoting a lot of effort with Brian, with the Duke Canine Cognition Center, to really focus on those dogs that really, until they're in training, so until they're, you know, coming up on a year and a half old, you know, we're not sure. Are they going to be good dogs, or are they going to have particular characteristics that may make them unsuitable?
So it's not until they're about a year and a half old then that you can really tell.
Yes, yeah.
And until then, they may just act like ordinary puppies.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, a lot of their time is spent acting like ordinary puppies. That's an important part of their of their socialization.
Yeah.
And you know, even, I should add, even when they're working, I mean, when they're not actually working, we want them to act like ordinary dogs and relax and play. I mean, that's an important part of the important part of their life. It's also an important part of the bond between the handler and the dog, that the dog is when it's off duty, so to speak, is relaxing and playing.
Someone has written an email saying that rescue dogs, mutts from shelters, can be trained to do this work just as well. And criticizing me, saying by asking about breed, you're enforcing stereotypes that these dogs need to be pedigreed and bred for this work. Amy?
I've assessed hundreds of dogs to be therapy dogs, and I've found that there are some types of dogs that are more predisposed to potentially being a therapy dog, retrievers, for example. But in the volunteers that I've worked with, we've seen everything from Great Danes to Chihuahuas and plenty of mixed breeds in between. So it really depends on that dog's demeanor. And although many dogs can be trained to be obedient, there's something innate in a therapy dog that they have the propensity to seek interaction with people. And so that's something that we really look for in therapy dogs.
I guess that's what I wonder about. You talked about a year and a half as the beginning point for really understanding whether a dog can move in to that sort of training. The issue is, during that year and a half, they've been exposed to an owner. Haven't they picked up some of their characteristics, not only been exposed to the good, but also the bad and the indifferent, Brian?
Well, I mean, truthfully, what we found is that the special skills that we discovered that make dogs remarkable, that made science so excited about paying attention to dogs finally. These are things that are really robust. They develop very early, so the ability to understand us, to communicate with us, to really respond to, sort of have an empathetic response. Those are things that come online very, very early, and actually we see them across breeds. There's very little that breed explains about this. And actually rearing history. So you can, I think, facilitate and help build on this. But I don't think some of the core things that make a dog, there's definitely individual variants, but it's not necessarily determined by breed.
Is there any real truth to the idea that there are no dumb dogs?
Well, I mean, that's what we argue in the book, The Genius of Dogs, is because if you think about where dogs come from, so they've been, dogs evolved 12 to 15,000 years ago, and wolves were their ancestor, And one day, some wolves decided to start hanging out near people and eating garbage. And that actually created selection, natural selection. It's not that people domesticated dogs. Wolves decided to start hanging out near people. And they started eating our garbage, which is a much more reliable source of food. And as a result, they were altered forever by that, because it's only a certain wolf that could do this. And so those wolves bred together. It made them friendlier. And we know from experiments on lots of different animals, if you have selection for friendliness, you have a whole bunch of changes, like you end up with floppy ears and curly tails and your coat color changes, etc. So imagine, though, the relationship with wolves 15,000 years ago. If you think it's controversial today, I think there would be a lot less controversy. I think any human that you met 15,000 years ago would hate wolves, because they eat what you eat. They're a direct competitor. And so the fact that basically a population of wolves was able to not only start relying on humans, but then actually now have evolved into what we all have at home. And keep in mind that most of the breeds are only about 150 years old. So the fact that you have all these animals that even sleep in your own bed, but they evolved from wolves that, you know, even today are, you know, not particularly beloved, and at the, you know, they don't live a lot of places where humans live. So, I mean, what a coup for that population of wolves that decided to hang out with humans.
Brian Harry, he's professor of evolutionary anthropology, director of the Duke Canine Cognition Center, co-author of a new book titled The Genius of Dogs, How Dogs Are Smarter Than You Think. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. In your book, you tell lots of stories, but there's a study in Japan that sort of knocked my socks off. It's about intestinal cancer.
Right. So there's a dog that's been trained to smell breath. It can smell your breath, and it was as effective as a colonoscopy at detecting whether you had intestinal cancer. And so next time you're at the doctor, just raise your hand and say, "Dog, please," because I would much rather have the dog smell my breath than have a colonoscopy. So hopefully this will be the future.
Are there other cancers that dogs seem to be able to detect?
This is an active area of research. And, you know, in all of these different dogs that are doing – and the first thing to emphasize is dogs have more dogs jobs than ever. You know, I listen to your show all the time, and it's – the Great Recession was horrible, and there's been a lot of suffering. But dogs in the age of the iPad and the internet actually have had a jobs boom. There are more jobs for dogs than ever. And so – because there are all these new jobs, researchers are trying to actually figure out how do they do it? Are they actually doing anything? And how do we increase the supply? But back to cancer, the answer is the one that's really well established is detection of melanomas. So dogs are very good at detecting melanomas.
Again, through smelling of the breath?
Correct. No, actually smelling the skin cancer on your body. They can detect if the spot is.
How widespread is that being known or used?
Well, I think that it's just like anything. With the medical community can't take this on board as a serious technology until it's very well established. And I think that the literature is becoming clear that it works. And now the question is, and this is very recent, in the last couple of years, it's become clear. And so now the question is this something that makes economic sense? And can we train enough dogs to serve enough people? But it certainly, dogs can detect melanoma.
And to you, Paul, I know Canine Companions has a puppy breeding program.
Yes.
But why are they all Goldens or Labrador Retrievers or a mix of the two?
It's those breeds, start out with a lot of the characteristics that we would like in service dogs. They aren't anxious typically about strangers. They're not the sort of dog that just bonds with one person and to the exclusion of other people. Our dogs are You know, they if they're with you, they're bonding with you and they love you. But, you know, when it's time for them to go from, say, the puppy raiser to training or then from training to the graduate they're going to be partnered with, you know, they'll make that move within nanoseconds, seemingly. I mean, they bond very quickly to new people. They're pretty unflappable in many environments. And so they form a great, and of course, physically, and just in terms of their size, and their health and their lifespans, they work very well in those.
Let me ask you about that, health and lifespans. Is it true that more Goldens are developing cancers?
Yes, it is. You know, Goldens have emerged, I mean, in terms of dogs with jobs and dogs as models. Golden Retrievers, unfortunately, have become models for cancer diagnostics and therapy and research, just because Goldens suffer pretty much the same cancers that humans do, and at a rate that's fairly high.
Is that fairly recent?
You know, that's a good question. It appears to be. Now, to what extent some of that is just increasing diagnostics is unknown, but it probably is the case that the frequency is increasing.
Paul Mundell, National Director of Canine Programs for Canine Companions for Independence.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Overbrook Foundation, a human rights foundation supporting freedom to marry, at freedomtomarry.org, by PBS, presenting TED Talks Education with John Legend, Bill Gates, and educator Jeffrey Canada, Tuesday at 10, 9 Central on PBS, and by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
Chain stores have made chic clothing cheap and accessible, but there's often a hidden cost, low wages and often unsafe working conditions in the countries where the production was outsourced. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the transformation of the clothing industry with Elizabeth Klein, author of Overdressed. Her research took her from the shopping mall to Bangladesh. Join us.
Welcome back. As we talk about dogs in the full range of their wonderful capacity, there is a question here which I'm sure affects lots of people. Says, how would you reconcile the idea of comfort/service dogs and people like me who are afraid of dogs? Amy.
Right. This is where the other end of the leash comes into effect, and that's the handler, the owner of the dog.
Of course.
So part of the training to be a therapy dog handler is to ensure that you receive permission to approach with your dog, because we know not everybody is a dog person. So we want to respect people who have the right not to interact with a dog as well.
I have to go the other way. I have a small long-haired chihuahua who is adorable. Everybody wants to pet him. And I say to them, let him come to you. Do
Correct.
Not lean over and put your hand on his head, because he's likely to take your finger off.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think it has to be a two-way street, Brian. Yeah.
Well, there's a really cool new initiative called the Yellow Ribbon Program, where if you have a dog like that, they're trying to sort of have a new norm be that you tie a yellow ribbon to the leash of your dog or to the collar, so that everybody can know if your dog has a yellow ribbon, this is a dog that you need to let approach you or talk to the owner before you touch them. And my dog's the same way. We have a yellow ribbon on our dog when we go out.
You do?
Oh, yes, yes,
interesting.
Yes. And there's...
Great idea.
There's nature versus nurture, and, you know, it's not... I should say nature and nurture. It's not nature versus nurture. Nature and nurture, and so it's not an owner's fault that your dog is that way. A lot of dogs are just... That's the way they're tuned.
Exactly.
And, obviously you can have dogs that were reared in a way that make them more aggressive, but it's an interaction of nature and nurture. But we can solve it all if people just put a yellow ribbon on their dog and if people knew that's what that meant. It's a great initiative.
And what I do is say to people, let him come to you. And invariably, he will, if he feels safe with that person. Instinctively, mm-hmm. they know mm-hmm. with whom they can feel safe. Otherwise, he doesn't go. Let's go to Miami, Florida. Good morning, April. You're on the air.
Good morning. I was a puppy raiser for Southeastern Guide Dogs. I raised a seeing eye dog puppy. And through that wonderful experience, I decided to make my dog, that subsequent dog, a German short hair pointer, a therapy dog. And Irma is 18 months old, and she is a reading education assistance dog. And what that means is we go into libraries and schools where children who are struggling reading aloud get to lay down with Irma on a special bed and read aloud to her in a very non-threatening manner, where she won't criticize the way they pronounce the word, or they're allowed to just read and enjoy reading. And it seems the children look forward to it every week, and mothers have said it makes their child want to read more and want to bring a book, and what book am I going to read to Irma next week? So I found it extremely rewarding, and she's a hunting dog, so not a typical therapy dog.
Wow,
but...
Brian.
Well, I think that caller raises, you know, just makes the point how many jobs dogs have now. And my job as a scientist, of course, is to be skeptical and ask the question, is it that these jobs that dogs are doing, are they actually doing anything? And I think basically in the book, as we review the literature, the answer is overwhelmingly yes. And so one of the exciting things to go forward is, for instance, a reading dog. What is that reading dog actually
yeah.
doing? Let's do some research and figure out, should we have reading dogs in every library? Or is it that only some dogs can do it, or that only some kids are affected? And, you know, how can we perfect this even better? So the fun one at Duke is that they're during exam time, they're exam dogs, and there's a room
to help calm
yeah, exactly.
people down.
There's a room in the library where you can go and hang out with puppies and dogs, because one of the things that has been established is that people who interact with dogs, they have a rise in a hormone that basically makes you feel more social, and a decrease in the hormone that makes you feel stressed out.
Amy.
Bailey and I were just at the University of Colorado Medical Library on Sunday to provide some stress relief for med students during finals week.
Really?
So, yes. And like Brian said, the research isn't there. I mean, studies regarding animal-assisted therapy date back to the 70s, but yet there's not enough rigorous science behind that. We all know anecdotally that these dogs are good for human health and well-being, but the science has really lagged behind. And so that's why American Humane Association has just launched a research study called Canines and Childhood Cancer, where we are implementing a randomized control trial across multiple children's hospitals to look at whether children who visit with a therapy dog during their chemotherapy sessions experience less distress than children who do not.
Wow. Just extraordinary. Thanks for calling, April. Let's go to Sherry in St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I was calling to say that a while back, I met a woman who had just moved to St. Louis from New York City, and she moved here with her family and two dogs. Well, our kids were about the same age, so we hit it off really well. She didn't live very far from us, about a mile, mile and a half. So we always visited each other's house, and the kids played there. Well, about 4 months after she lived here, her dog started to chronically escape the yard. And my friend was always going out, getting the dogs, and then bringing them back to her house. Well, during this period, I was sitting at my home alone, and I was sitting at my kitchen table, and I heard a noise at my door, and I got very frightened because I didn't see anyone. Finally, I got up the nerve to go to the door, and I looked out the window, and there were her two dogs pawing at my door, and they had never been to my house. I was certain that they were purposely pawing at my door, and I opened it up, and they came right in, and they sat down like they were ready for a treat. I sent her a picture. I said, look who has visited my house.
Oh, my goodness. Well, dogs do have a sense of direction.
Well, so that story is a beautiful example of, the excitement of doing science on dogs or with dogs is that there's a lot we don't understand and a lot we don't know. And so if you ask me how did the dogs do that as a scientist, well, I'm supposed to know that because I'm Mr. Fancy Scientist Person. I have no idea. and to be honest, and that's part of the fun is there's a lot of mystery.
Sure.
There is some things that seem a little bit magical. So the I think that's one of the reasons that's so exciting that scientists are now excited
exactly.
about dogs.
Exactly. Here is an email, from a person who says, I have MS and use a service dog for mobility assistance. Are therapy dogs covered similarly under the ADA or are requirements different, Paul?
Well, let me first give the disclaimer that I'm not an attorney, and so I'm giving you my opinion in
sure.
reading, but they're different. The Americans with Disabilities Act, which was further clarified in 2010, really specifies that the act applies to humans, not to dogs, and so by definition, the dog that's covered under the ADA is covered because they're with a human. So it's the person that the law is really applying to, not the dog. And so if you think about that in that context, you realize that like a service dog or a guide dog, because they're helping a person with a disability kind of mitigate those problems, they've been individually trained, as the law states, to help to do certain behaviors to help with the problems that a person with a disability may have. It's by virtue of that that they're covered under the Americans with Disabilities Law and have access. Now, a therapy dog doesn't meet those criteria, and so it's not covered under that law.
And what about a comfort dog?
The comfort dog under the ADA is considered the same as a therapy dog. Now, we should say, as we were discussing earlier, the caveat there is that local ordinances may change
and the
that.
The law is evolving.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to Elk Ridge, Maryland. Cecilia, you're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I am an Army occupational therapist who was fortunate enough to deploy to Iraq with a therapy dog. We responded to many traumatic events, but the one that I particularly remember was an incident in which five service members were killed. The eve of that event, myself and my dog, who actually had a rank, she was Sergeant Bo, we responded to the event with some other mental health providers and a chaplain. I remember waiting outside, waiting to visit the unit that had been affected, when a young sergeant came out and she kindly asked everyone to leave. She basically said they just wanted to be alone. as we started to walk away, she turned to me and she said, "Ma'am, you and Sergeant Bo can come in." And we went in that night, and I'll never forget it. And I think they really did not want to talk. They kind of just wanted to mourn for a little bit. But having the dog there was a very, it was almost a comforting thing for them. And I just think that that's a very good example of what a therapy dog can do in a traumatic situation, a traumatic event.
And we have an email from Cindy who says, "What about the role dogs are playing helping people in the military who are dealing with PTSD, anxiety, and depression?" Cecilia, I want to thank you for that call and for telling us that story. I'm so moved. What about the VA? Is it recognizing the role that dogs are playing? Amy.
Recently, there was a study that the VA was conducting regarding therapy dogs or service dogs with returning veterans with PTSD. They've since stopped that study, and American Humane Association has called for them to reopen this and look at this, because these service members are definitely in need of help, and there are great organizations that are ready to provide service dogs along with CCI and American Humane Association for these veterans. And so it's a problem that needs to be corrected.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm happy to say it really does look like the VA will restart that study. There were some methodological problems, you might say, with the way that the study was initially designed. But it looks as though it's going to be relaunched, and we're hopeful that it'll bear fruit.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I don't think that this is a joke, but Ann in Indianapolis, I gather you have a rather unusual therapy animal.
Good morning.
Good morning.
This is so exciting to be on your show. But yes, I do. I have Harley. He's a potbelly pig, and he was evaluated by Pet Partners this weekend. And somebody mentioned the ratings earlier that they could be predictable or complicated environments. So he was evaluated as being able to work in a predictable environment. So I'm a social worker. I work with clients with developmental disability and mental illness. So he'll be working with me and with my clients and going into group facilities during the days. And
well, and tell me what the reaction is from the people who see this potbelly pig. How much does the potbelly pig weigh?
He's about 35 pounds.
35?
He's about the size of our Puggle. He's not very big.
I see. And what does he do?
He just delights everybody. He makes little grunting noises, and if you scratch his belly, he falls over, and he rubs against people, and he takes snacks very gently from their hands, and he'll walk with people. And
I can't resist asking you, what's your potbelly pig's name?
Harley.
Is Harley housebroken?
He is.
So
he sleeps with my son at night.
I thought so.
He's totally a house pig. Uh-huh. Yeah. He just goes out to go to the bathroom.
Now, it seems to me, Brian, you are going to have to expand your anthropological studies to take into account. This is not the first potbelly pig I've heard about.
Right, and the thing to know about potbelly pigs, just to be clear, so don't everybody go run and buy one now, because they actually can be hundreds of pounds by the time they grow up. So don't be surprised when your little potbelly pig gets really big. But domesticated animals, I've seen llamas are being used. This person's using pigs to great effect. And so while dogs are used very, very effectively, it doesn't necessarily mean they can corner the whole market. But I would say that I'm not aware of any research on other animals besides dogs being used in this way. That doesn't mean that they aren't effective.
Exactly.
It does not mean that, but it just means we don't know.
We don't know. And yet, Clearly, Anne has experienced something that not only she finds valuable, but the people around her do, all of which says to me that there is a far closer relationship between us and the animal world than we have any idea of. Dogs, because they live with us so frequently, are the ones we study. But I'll bet eventually, perhaps not in my lifetime, but in yours, you may find really strong connections. Amy, any last words?
Yes, I wanted to say that, of course, dogs are the most prevalent therapy animal, but there are other breeds or other species that do as their therapy. Cats, goats, llamas, miniature horses, chickens, rats. So, yes, there's room in people's hearts to love all these kinds of animals.
All right, we'll leave it at that. Thanks for your call, Anne, and take good care of Harley, your pot-bellied pig. Amy McCullough, she's National Director of Animal-Assisted Therapy for the American Humane Association. Brian Hare is Professor of Evolutionary Anthropology, author of The Genius of Dogs, and Paul Mundell, National Director of Canine Programs for Canine Companions for Independence. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Ring.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.